Come on up. That's Michael Perry, ladies and gentlemen. What are you doing sitting in the audience? Sitting up here waiting for you. Have a seat. How are you? Nice to see you. Looking good.
Well, thank you. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's true because it's been
you don't think it's
10 years.
Since what?
Since we met. Since I first stepped up on this stage, sat down, and knocked over your ostrich, which led us to a five-minute discussion about dead emus.
Yes. It did? And, you want to do it again?
I'll do it again.
You haven't changed a bit. You're still knocking over the emus and calling them ostriches and everything else.
Had a lot of hair back then.
How are things?
Well, I don't have as much hair, and I've got reading glasses.
Do you?
Other than that, things are great.
You know, life happens. Life happens while you're doing other things, you know. The new book is Visiting Tom. You don't, do you run or anything like that, or do any sort of form of exercise? Or?
I did just last night. I ran along the lake here.
Oh, you did?
For about 20 yards, then I took a nice walk.
Yeah. You ran on the lake? I thought that you could do something like that. You ran around it, not on it.
Around it.
Around it, yeah. But do you do that? Do you have a regimen?
I do. It's a little abstract.
Well, we're anxious to hear that, aren't we?
I write in the book, actually, this book here, Visiting Tom, which will be out Tuesday.
Well, I was going to mention that. I mentioned Visiting Tom. Michael Perry, Visiting Tom, available on Harper.
It's available anywhere. You can even pre-order it right now. Yeah, if you want. Some people go to sneezingcow.com and do that. But it's a free country.
Right, I love you, because you never self-promotional. That's what I like best about it.
But I write in the book about going for a run. Our little farm's at the end of a real steep hill.
Yeah.
And it's such a steep hill that the local high school cross-country coach uses it. He hauls the kids out in a van and makes them run up and down the hill. But he always puts these little promotional or these little motivational sayings in chalk on the road. And he's got markings all the way up, like 500 yards to go, and you can do it. And there's one about... Oh, I don't know. It's probably about 40 yards from the very top, and it always says, pop the top. And every time I cross that these days, I just go, son, that happened about half a mile ago.
What does that even mean, pop the top? It doesn't crack a beer or something.
I'm afraid to ask.
High school cross country.
It is a dead-end road, and you do find the occasional empty beer can up there, so who am I to ask?
Is that actually, it was Stuckey Road? Is that actually the name? That's not the name of it, right? Change the name of the road.
I call it Starkey Road in the book. I change it just slightly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I've got...
No. So it is Stuckey Road, then?
No, you're close. But you'll get Stuckey if you try to get there when it's snowing. Yeah.
That's right. In fact, that's a big part of this book is your road and how they ruined it. The only way you can get up it is you got to make a go at it.
You used to be able to get a run at it, and the highway commissioner decided to redesign the intersection. I want to preface this by saying that he is a good man doing a very difficult job. And it's one of those jobs where no one ever pays attention to you until you do something you don't agree with.
Right.
And he and I, well, I respect what he did and why he did it. I may, however, not be on his Christmas card list.
Yeah.
So now you got to use some other resources to get up.
So they said people coming down, which would be you, I guess.
Right, there are two houses.
Because weren't stopping.
Top. Yeah, he said. Well, the problem is there's a steep hill and people are shooting off through that intersection. And someone's going to get hit. Well, there's only two families. There's only three driver's licenses at the top of the hill. and it's a dead end. And then there's a yield sign at the bottom of the hill. So I said, well, how about if you put up a stop sign and then people have to stop? And he said, well, there's no saying they'd stop.
No.
I said, well, if that's your theory, then why would you put up a stop sign or red light anywhere? And he said, well, there are studies that show that uncontrolled intersections actually are safer. And at that point, my response was, what? And he's right. In Europe, there's been some studies where they have uncontrolled intersections, but they're at the center of dense urban centers where there are a lot of bicycles and people from Holland.
Right.
But I'm suggesting that
there's canals at the end, so you're going to stop.
And so what I wanted to say was, well, if you really believe that, let's start saving some taxpayer money. I'll get the truck. Let's go start yanking stoplights.
Yeah, yank them.
I didn't say that, though.
Twist them off. Get one of them pipe cutters you probably got.
Yeah, let's let everybody just be, what do they call that, libertarian?
Yeah. I'm not allowed to say that.
He's got a hard job.
Tell him about your sign now. Because you're at a dead end, and you get people coming there and walking through your property.
We live at the end of a big, tall hill, and then after that, our driveway goes on another 2/10 of a mile, and it's shot. It's full of potholes and weeds, and it was blacktopped in about 1956, I think. But I like that, because I figure that slows people down and makes them feel like maybe they shouldn't come any further or farther, depending on whether you're an English major. And
I never got that either.
So we had trouble people driving back and just showing up in our yard and looking around and hanging out. And so someone said, well, put up a no trespassing sign or a keep out sign. I said, no, I don't want to do that. That's kind of not very neighborly. And where I came from, you know, when my dad bought the farm, he was a newcomer from the city. And for the first year that come deer hunting, the neighbors just hunt on your land like they always did. The second year, they hunt there again, but you have a little talk with them. And then on the third year, you're allowed to hunt on your own land. Right?
Including the neighbors.
Right, and it's a process, and it works itself out. Well, nowadays, of course, we're of a different mindset. And the minute you buy your little patch, you slap no trespassing signs up every 40 feet, and that's just... So I didn't want to do that, but eventually all the people driving in without permission got to me. So I said, well, I'm just going to make a nice little sign, put it at the end of the driveway, it says, private drive. And then I got to thinking, well, if you put up a nice little sign, people think you have nice things. I'm not complaining, but we live in an old slantwise farmhouse. The windows don't match and everything. And I do have a pole barn with some precious things. But the most precious thing is a 1951 International Harvester pickup, 3/4 ton. No one in the county could get it started if they had to. So I went the other way. And what I did is I said, you want to send a certain message, and it's not just the words. And so I went to the pole barn. I found two old pieces of lumber that were pretty much shot. I found an old rattle can full of blood red spray paint, and I propped those boards up, and I sprayed real slow in all capital letters, private on one board and drive on the other, and I oversprayed so that the red paint would run. And then I took the boards out, and I leaned them up against the box elder stump, and I got my Ruger Red Hawk 44 Magnum with the 7-inch barrel. And I put 6 240-grain slugs in it, and I shot them all through that sign. What I was trying to do, that's what artists call creating a vernacular piece. Right? And so then I took it out the end of the driveway, and I screwed it to a popple tree with drywall screws. Drywall screws are the sign of an incompetent carpenter, and, of course, I buy them by the box. So I was pretty proud of myself, I admit. For the next couple of weeks, I'd drive in, I'd see that blood red private drive sign with the bullet holes screwed to the popple tree, and I thought, yeah, you know, people, not only are they seeing keep out, but they're wondering, wow, what kind of guy would put up a sign like that? Until about 2 weeks in, when I looked at it, and I became crestfallen because I realized that I had blown the opportunity to make the perfect private drive sign, and so I redid it, and now it's still too... scrubby old board screwed to the popple tree with drywall, and it's still the blood red overspray, and there's still the bullet holes. But now, if you come to the end of my driveway, you'll see a sign that says Pervit Drive.
All right, that's gonna be hard to beat, but let's talk novelty. Novelty implements of various types, such as the vice grip, your welded vice grip device.
Oh, yeah. I said when I have an auction, you know, they're going to clean out my pole barn, and there's nothing in there much worth other than that 1951 International Harvester 3/4 ton long bed pickup truck.
You're going to get offers now if you keep mentioning it. You know that.
I have a personal attachment to that truck because I spent my first night as a married man in the back of it, and I asked... In the book Truck, A Love Story, also available.
Yes. You have that, you know that up?
I write about, I asked my wife if we could spend the first night of our married life in the back of my 1951 International, and when she said yes, I knew I'd made the right call. Yeah.
Definitely.
But there's a lot of junk in my pole barn, and most of it's worth nothing. But they're going to, you know, when I grew up, we always used to go to auctions. That was our form of entertainment, because the rural auctioneers... There were comedians and they were improv artists, and they can sell anything, and they had all these one-liners, and they could improvise jokes depending on what the implement was. And I'm just waiting the day that they go to sell my stuff, they're going to pick up this vice grips, And there's a perfectly normal vice grips, but on the back is welded the grab hook from a logging chain. And he's going to hold that up, but if he's a good auctioneer, he won't even hesitate. He'll make some comment about dentistry, and then he'll sell it for $2. But what he won't know is that this whole book is about my neighbor, Tom. And Tom is, I call him a roughneck polymath. He can do anything. He drove his own oxen. He made the oxbows that he drove the oxen with. He's a farmer. He milked cows for years. He's got his old Model A still running. He builds his own cannons and shoots them. And he's just a super smart, talented guy, and he's one of those guys that, you know, they're disappearing. He can just do everything. But I needed to weld this grab hook to the back of my vice grips. And when I went over to Tom's, I gave him that hook and that vice grips, and I said, can you weld those together? And he said, yep, I can. And then he set them aside, which means, but I ain't going to do it now. And so a couple days later, his wife called, and it was ready. That's a rural thing, too. I'm, you know, you're going to have to herd me back to where he wanted me to go. I'm getting way off on a tangent here. But where I grew up, we had it was a lot of loggers and farmers, and you know, folks didn't have a lot. But there were a lot of lakes, so a lot of people bought lake property, and they'd build nice places. And they would hire my buddies locally to do, like, pull the docks out and stack firewood and move rocks. And it was always funny because the new people would always, they'd hire them to move the dock, and then my buddy wouldn't show up, and they'd start calling him. When are you going to, we need you to come by Friday. You got to be here at 10. And the people from the city don't know it, but my buddies, they keep a list, and your level on the list is inversely proportional to the number of times you called and told them to hurry up. So when I brought that thing over and showed it to Tom, we were having supper with him, and I said, can you do this? And he said, yep, and then he set it aside. I knew that he just moved me down the list, and I just didn't need to ask. And so a couple days later, he called, and I went over, and it was ready, and he'd welded it to the back. And what it is we feed our family off our farm quite a bit, including deer hunting, and that vice grips is an integral part of my deer skinner, my automatic deer skinner, which is something I had wanted for years. I had dreamed of the day I'd have my own deer skinner, and it's based on a snatch block pulley system that's hooked to the rafters in the pole barn, and I got an old boat winch, and that's how I pulled the deer out of its hide. And that's probably enough said, but people react like this, but I'm just trying to feed my family healthy meat. And in the book, I said, you know, me to my deer skinner, it's the equivalent of a Manhattan Yogi to her brushed aluminum juicer. You know, we're both just trying to feed the kids.
Your point is well taken.
Thank you.
And so is your vice grip, I might add. So, is that when he showed you the shovel? That is a little.
Oh yeah, he's got a shovel. He's got a shovel. He's got all. And in the book I write about when you go to see him, he's got all these great routines he takes you through, and he's a funny guy, and he's got this shovel. He'll save it for last when he thinks you're about to leave. He pulls that out. That's his big finish piece, and he pulls this shovel out, and it looks like a perfectly normal spade. But the handle comes up about 3 feet, and then it curves all the way around and points back down. And I know, because I've known him for years, that what it is, that shovel handle is a failed oxbow. It's one he started to make an oxbow with and didn't work out. But then he shaved it down, he put in that shovel, just so that he can tell the following joke. He'll pull that shovel out, and he'll hold it up, and he goes, what do you think that is? People look at it, and they might guess. And then they'll go, that's a shovel we picked up after them county boys got done leaning on it.
That's a county shovel. Oh. So wouldn't you say that in country life, one of the things you got to know is somebody who welds, basically.
It doesn't hurt. Now, I can weld, and I've written, I do what's called bubblegum welding, and anybody who welds knows that I can slather a bead on there, and it'll hold for a week or so. But if you want it to last, you're probably going to want to go to someone like Tom.
Yeah.
He can do it all. And what amazes me is he fixes old things, but he's got a lathe. And he'll show you. He says the newest patent on here is 1918. Yeah. But I was over there the other day, and he's making parts for a guy's $250,000 combine. So, you know, he's not just
hopefully
an old timer hanging
out.
See
the lathe. That's what he made of.
No, the guy was standing right there.
Oh,
they
was,
trust
yeah.
him. Oh, yeah, you bet. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was serious there for a minute.
That's okay. I'm sure it won't happen again. How to overcome improvements. Living in the country, to say some of these things, Noah Welder. Learn how to overcome improvements.
Yes.
That's part of it, isn't it? I mean, that's the whole thing with this road and everything. They improved your road.
Right, but then he kept telling me, here's how we can overcome what I've just done to improve.
Yeah.
He wrote, and I said, I didn't want to be a grammatic stickler. You know, but the idea of improvement would seem to imply that it would be easier to get up the hill.
Yeah, yeah. So that, there is that. What do I got here now? Smart feller, girl raising advice. So he had two girls too. Did he have two girls too?
He does.
You have
he
two girls. I have two girls. So yeah. We're all in the same boat here.
Yeah, like someone told me.
And it's perplexing.
Me, yeah, well, some guy told me once on BookTree, he said, you don't have a family, you have a sorority.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Feels that way sometimes.
It is. Yeah. And yeah. The vote is always 3-1 against, I've noticed.
Well, and you can negotiate, but it's pointless.
Yeah. That's a better way of saying that, I think.
So I look to him for advice sometimes.
Yeah.
But the deal with him is if you ask him, if you hang out with him, you learn a lot. If you ask him stuff, then he a lot of times just gives you a smart aleck answer.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
No.
I did ask him specifically for advice on how to raise my daughters, and the first two things he came up with, I'm not even sure we can say on the air.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No, you're probably right.
So as I wrote in the book, I said, I did not jot these down.
Yeah, okay.
I couldn't see this in that cute How to Be a Dad book.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a little unnerving.
Nothing useful then, huh?
No, the thing with him, and here's my favorite story from the whole book, which I shouldn't tell, you know, because now I gave you my favorite story from the whole book, but he's one of these guys.
Free, absolutely free.
Right. My whole point of this book was not to write, he's not my guide, my spiritual mentor. I'm not his, I have no claim on him. All the other neighbors are over there as much or more as I am. I just wanted to write about what you could learn from a guy just being his neighbor. And so that's what the book's about. But there was one time after I'd known him for some time, we're sitting at his dining room table, and we'd had a pretty long talk, and it was a nice talk, and he's 82, and his wife is his age, and she's in failing health, and it just struck me, you know, these conversations won't go on forever. And I was feeling pretty vulnerable, I think, and I just, there was something I wanted to carry into the future. So I looked at him, I said, Tom, all these years, all this living, all these experiences, do you have any regrets? And he looked at me, and he said, well, sure. And he never said another word.
Now, I mean, his farm, though, had that ungodly occurrence of having an interstate come right past the barn.
Part of the reason that my little thing with the intersection, it's more for comic relief than anything. And I also use it as this silly little parallel to what he actually experienced, which is he's living on the same farm that he's lived on for 82 years straight. It's this very remote spot. The only connection to the outside world was a dirt two-track. And he would, as a kid, leave the porch, go down past the barn, down this cutback, down to the creek, and he'd play by the creek, and he'd find arrowheads and that sort of thing. And then he'd cross the footbridge and walk to his little one-room school. Well, then he took over the farm as a grown man, and in the 1960s, the U.S. government put an interstate through his barn, basically, right through his yard. They actually had the line drawn through his barn. He was able to get him to move it enough to save his barn. But he went from living in this remote little spot to having, today he has 22,300 vehicles a day, over 8 million vehicles a year going literally through his yard. You could spit on them from the barn. And if there is an overarching point to anything I write, it's this, I'm always looking for equanimity. How do you deal with what life throws you? And here's a guy, and believe me, he can go on a rant, and I write about it in the book, about what he thinks of the process and how that road got there. But he didn't let it wreck his life. He's filled with equanimity. He's got a sense of humor. He's lived fully. He's lived an engaged life. He continued to farm. He continues to love that place. And so that's what I'm trying to get at in the book is how do we deal with these imperfections and these intrusions on our inner peace and not get bitter and grumpy.
But he made him move the fence, right?
He did make him move the fence. He set it all up, and he showed him the problem, and then he had the committee come out there, and he said, well, he set up a silage wagon with an old farmall tractor and showed him where it had to go, and he said, all right, if any one of you fellas want to back that in there, have a crack at it. And none of them could do it.
Without hitting the stakes.
That's right, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. You're not, now, I noticed by your hands, you are not yourself a farmer.
No, and I make a point of this in the book. Now, for promotional purposes of promotional shorthand, I'm often portrayed as a bit of a rugged northern Wisconsin fellow, and I do raise some pigs and chickens now and then, but if you're down at the feed mill with me, and I do go to the feed mill, and I do talk about feeder hogs and hang out and pout about the weather, but but if the guys at the feed mill want to embarrass me, they just have me turn my hands over, and they are clearly the hands of a typist. So, yeah, my brother's a real farmer, and I always say it's nice when people call me a farmer. But if I come home after a weekend on the road and all my pigs are dead, that's a bad weekend.
That's a bad feeling.
Right. But if my brother comes home and all his corn is dead, which this year isn't really much of a joke, he bet the farm.
Yeah. Well, it's once again great to have you here. The new one is called Visiting Tom, from Michael Perry, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. Thanks, Mike.
It's a pleasure.
Good to see you, as always. Michael Perry.